afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. And I'm here with my co-host today, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It's Monday, July 9th, 2018. July 9th. It's just incredible. But there's so many things going on, Dave, that it makes the time go by fast. And I always said, if you want to slow down time, you just go visit your dentist and have a tooth pulled. That really slows down time.
Oh. Well, there you go.
So how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm magnificent.
Well, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. There's a lot of good things going on today, starting with gold. We have a little bit of a turnaround today, but, you know, they couldn't let it get too far ahead of itself. So we're still showing about $3.80 for the gold market. The New York spot price, $1,259.30. Silver is up 6 cents today at 1618. Platinum was up 7 at 854, along with palladium was also up that amount at 964. The USDX today was stronger by 0.11, although earlier in the day it was weaker at 94.10. Crude oil was up another quarter at 74.05. And yes, the paper markets, everyone is back from the holiday of last week with the Independence Day. And the traders are back in force, and they're going to throw away all the United States economy problems, and they're just going to focus on the second quarter earnings. It's all that's important. And I bet they're real excited to, you know, everyone's anticipating a very large GDP. So, but the Dow was up 320 points today for what? Because now we're going to focus on second quarter earnings before they even come out. Did anybody even report yet? Dave?
No.
But we're getting ready for them. Then what happens if they're not as good as? Anyway, 24,776. You have the NASDAQ up 67 points at 7,756. And the S&P is up 24, 2,784. 10-year yield, 2.86%. Euro is a little weaker. And, hey, nobody really cares anymore. We have Japan, Hong Kong. Everybody was higher. It just doesn't seem anything that matters anymore. We're going to, you know, just continue going forward, and to me, as far as seeing these types of numbers today with all the news that's going on out there, and I guess maybe even the you know, the announcement this evening for the Supreme Court justice, you know, hey, let's all build this up at 9 o'clock this evening, got to do it during Sean Hannity's hour. I mean, it's just like everybody's just all happy, and it just baffles me. Anyway, we live in a strange, strange world. We do.
Start calling it the Mr. Rogers market, Melody. You know, everything seems to be hunky-dory in the neighborhood.
Hunky-dory in the neighborhood. Mm. And good, we'll have to start talking like he did also. Good afternoon, Dave. Welcome to the neighborhood.
And Melody, it's good to be here with you.
Well, thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, we also include you. Welcome for joining us today. But let's get serious and let's get down to this is interesting because it says that, you know, U.S. homeowners today are getting richer by the minute. And they are less likely to cash in on their newfound wealth than during previous housing booms. And, of course, we're talking about home equity. And as home values rise, your home equity lines of credit are often used to tap it. And the overall amount of money people are talking or taking out of their homes is shrinking. The collective amount of so-called tappable equity, which is the appraised value of the home minus the 20% most lenders require borrowers to keep as a safety net, grew by 7% in the first quarter of 2018. And that's the largest single quarter growth since this figure started to be tracked back in 2005. It stands at $5.8 trillion, and that's the highest ever recorded. And it's up 16.5% compared to a year ago.
Yeah, the average homeowner with a mortgage gained just shy of $15,000 in tappable equity over the past year and now has about $114,000 available to draw upon on average. That's the amount over the 20% of the value of the average home that you just mentioned. But the lines of credit have variable interest rates, unlike the 30-year fixed primary mortgage. So the rate on the so-called HELOC or HELOC, that's the line of credit, can change. A HELOC is therefore riskier. And, you know, because, the Fed has been raising rates steadily, the HELOCs follow that. That's why we pay so much attention to especially the 10-year Treasury note, which a lot of mortgage rates movements and consumer loan rate movements are based on. You know, Ken Grabowski, who's executive VP of Black Knight's Data and Analytics Division, said, who wants uncertainty when it comes to monthly finances? I think a lot of Americans look at, what are my payments? What's my income coming in? And what are my payments going out? You know, nearly 80% of tappable equity, that's four out of every $5, is held by homeowners whose current mortgage interest rate is below 4.5%. 60% of it is held by borrowers whose rate is below 4%. The average rate on a 30-year fixed today, Melody, is roughly 4.8%, that according to the Mortgage Banker Association.
Well, you know, those that are tapping the equity are doing it more through a cash-out refinances than HELOCs because they're leery of these variable rates. Just 1.2% of available equity was tapped in this first quarter of this year. And that's pretty much the lowest amount in 4 years. Maybe consumers, homeowners have, maybe their memories are a little bit longer. I don't think so, but they still remember the housing crash. And that was only 10 years ago. Maybe there's a little pain left. You have a lot of borrowers who've lost their homes to foreclosure because they did use them like ATMs. And there was other areas that was also corrupt. You have the appraisers who were in on the, you had everybody that was in on the game back then, and it is a little bit more difficult this time. And maybe that's it. Maybe they can't. Maybe their credit isn't as good to take it out anymore, Dave. And the banks are a little bit harder on borrowers. It's a little bit harder to, back then, as long as you had a pulse, you were able to get a loan. You were able to get those equity loans. So, perhaps we did see things tighten up. Now, I don't know, with a lot of these regulations being dropped, and that I think might just be the key. You can't have this amount of money sitting there and the government's not going to get that come flowing through the economy. So I wonder, Dave, if on the regulations that have been dropped for the banks and so forth, if it'll allow them to make it a little bit easier for the consumer to tap his equity, if that was perhaps part of the problem.
It's something we'll have to look into. I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, we have seen home prices go higher. Everyone always expects them to go higher. There's confidence in the housing market. It's beginning to drop, though. It's not as strong as it once was. And So I think it's great that people aren't using their equities, but I'd like to know why they're not, because we live in a consumer society, and yes, memories are, pretty short, and 10 years is still 10 years, and everybody always thinks we live in a different new world, we're going into a new paradigm.
Yeah, indeed, and now, beginning this year, interest on lines of credit are no longer deductible, so we will probably be seeing even less of that being tapped unless Congress decides to reinstate it.
Although those are for the but that's only on there for 8 years, then that'll fall off, and I would assume that it would be deductible again, unless they make those tax cuts permanent.
Permanent, correct.
Yeah, but they're not permanent right now. But, you know, some are saying that this low employment is actually increasing competition between states. There's a restaurant in Madison, Wisconsin, who has managed to pull off a rare feat. Not only has it stayed in business for 6 years, it's also still routinely referred to as trendy. People were showing up for dinner by 5 p.m. on a weeknight. Business was good, but it could be so much better. The restaurant is open only for dinner, and it's closed on Sundays, and he would love to do more if he could only staff the place. Like some, you know what? I just can't believe they can't find anybody to waiter, you know, to waitress. Like so many employers across the country, they're stuck in what experts call the skills gap. They're unable to fill skilled positions. Hello, my name is Melody. Have you decided what you're going to order for the day?
I hear
and
you.
I waitressed a lot of years in my youth, so I'm not making fun of the occupation at all. But now it is, you know, the only thing I could say, Dave, on this, and then you can fill us in about the skill gaps, is that they call this restaurant trendy. So does that define the type of clientele coming in there? Is it a higher end of clientele? And, you know, you can't train somebody to take an order? I mean,
I don't know. We'll have to look them up and see what, you know, what customers are saying, what their menu looks like. But it sure sounds like that a chef, a host or hostess, and a wait person is not necessarily the same thing throughout the restaurant industry. But, you know, John Hunter, who's the owner of this particular restaurant, said working in the kitchen at a gourmet restaurant like his takes specialized skills. And that skills gap has been around for a while. And it may help explain why, for at least the last 4 years anyway, the category workforce has been the most heavily weighted category in a number of surveys and studies, including CNBC's America's Top States for Business study. Employers are now clamoring for talent, and states are touting their people. A recent survey of the CNBC Global CFO Council, Chief Financial Officers, which represents a cross-section of public and private companies, found that roughly 83% of respondents said their company has had trouble finding qualified workers to fill skilled positions. And lately, that skills gap is getting worse. And that's thanks to historically low unemployment. 4% nationwide in June, at least according to our government. Now it's not just the skilled workers who are in short supply, it's workers, period. The shortage has some states going to extremes to attract workers, Melody. Vermont, for one, is offering $10,000 grants to people willing to move to the state and work remotely in their current job. Indiana set up a web portal to attract veterans as they leave the military. In North Platte, Nebraska, the local chamber of commerce is offering to match employers' signing bonuses up to $5,000. It's, whew, I mean, these are just a couple of examples, but if they, you know, are representative of what's going on out there, you know, at large, well, then we're living in an interesting time indeed.
Well, you know, it just really doesn't, I just find it a little hard to believe, you know. Of course, you have people working two jobs in order to make an income. You know, they don't talk about that. You know, you wonder how many, it's hard to believe. I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's just hard to believe that we don't have people for jobs, you know. But anyway, I mean, because this certainly doesn't seem like we're in an era of, you know, previous economic recoveries with GDPs higher than what we've been experiencing, you know. So it just doesn't seem, it just doesn't, I mean, I talk to people day in and day out. that you know, it's just not that easy to find a decent job. And so it's, why would Vermont, I mean, they're offering $10,000 just to move there. They probably get more in taxes, though. So I don't know. It's just trying to connect the dots, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm rambling, so I'll just, you know, it's kind of reminds me of the baseball field. What was the name of that movie, Dave?
That would be, oh, my God, Kevin Costner.
Kevin, if you build it, they will come.
Field of Dreams.
Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come. So in Wisconsin, I don't know. In Wisconsin, the situation is bordering on desperate. Unemployment in May hit a new record low of 2.8%. That's among the lowest rates in the nation, and it comes before hiring begins at the giant Foxconn plant that just began construction. The Taiwanese manufacturer has promised to hire as many 13,000 people to build giant video displays in exchange for $4.5 billion in state and local incentives. It's not clear where, you know, they're going to find those workers. But they got $4.5 billion in state and local tax incentives. The electronics, just for 13,000 people. It's a lot of money. The electronics giant Foxconn Technology Group is building a massive manufacturing campus. Let's see if there's anything else interesting about that. So they're going to either have to pump up the pay if they need to attract workers. Right, Dave?
That's true. That's true. You know, Wisconsin's taking a position that workers will be naturally drawn not only to the facility, but to the tech community it hopes to develop around it, you know, which the state has dubbed Wisconn Valley. That's clever. But officials there aren't leaving the issue to chance. Tricia Braun, who's COO at you know, the Wisconsin Economic Development Agency, that's the state's business development arm, said, as companies continue to grow, we want to make sure they have the people that they need to be successful. So the agency is looking to all corners of the state, including rural areas in northern Wisconsin, where unemployment's higher, and it's targeting all walks of life. You know, focusing now on, you know, technical schools, vo-tech programs in high school, and even putting training facilities in some of the state correctional institutions.
Hey, we hear the music and we're heading into a break. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with Dave Allen, and we will return right after these few short messages.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk TimUpRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for a weekly newsletter. And we're going to touch a little bit on Dave's article that's in the newsletter today. But make sure you get to the website because there's other articles. There's an article there from Wendy Wilson, Apothecary Herbs, and we also have a Doug Nolan section, and we do the market report also, so make sure you sign up, dgscoins.com. I just want to finish up a little bit about, you're talking about housing in the first segment of the program, and before we move on to the five countries that are contributing to rising geopolitical volatility, which all has an impact on the gold and silver markets, and it should anyway. And if it doesn't today, it will, and it will in a big time. I just wanted to finish up that part about the residential rents are hitting an all-time high. The national average rent reached an all-time high of $1,405 in June. And that's a 3% increase from a year earlier. And again, it's the latest sign of perhaps, or is it a sign of U.S. economic boom that's pushing these prices higher? Just as job growth breaks another record, wages aren't rising, so I don't know why rents would be rising. Wages aren't rising.
Yeah.
But the Federal Reserve, huh?
Good point.
Yeah, but the Federal Reserve says it's starting to get concerned that the economy may overheat. Of the 250 biggest U.S. cities, 88% saw increased rents, 10% were unchanged, and just 2% fell compared with June of 2017. And of course, it's funny that the 20 biggest increases were in small cities, where population migration and the strengthening economy are accelerating rent growth. So that's kind of interesting. Or maybe that the smaller cities are outside the bigger cities and people can't afford the bigger cities, so they're also moving to the smaller.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'll have to take a look see if how it breaks these increases down. I mean, it could vary. I mean, for all we know, the increased rents are happening at the upper end of the market, where people of, you know, higher means live, although they, you know, they tend by and large, my guess, you know, to own homes. Nevertheless, I mean, you know, relatively speaking, again, it could be that, you know, maybe it's the, you know, the $2,000 a month rents that are going up by these amounts, and maybe it's, you know, the $600-$800 a month rents are staying more steady. But two oil boom cities in Texas led the charge, you know, with average increases in Midland of 39% and Odessa at 37%. The LA suburb, Lancaster, California, Reno, Nevada, and Peoria, Arizona, which is a Phoenix suburb, they all had average rent increases of about 10%. Now, megacities didn't escape the boom, even with lower percentage increases. Manhattan, for example, broke its 12-month streak of rent declines, or just, you know, very small growth, with a June increase of, 1.5% compared to June 2017. Orlando led the megacity rent increases at roughly 8.5%, which Yardi called the most significant growth in its category. Las Vegas, which we're hearing is on the so-called mend in this area, led larger cities higher, up 7%, followed by Phoenix at about 6.5%. Sacramento, California, Mesa, Arizona, They were next at about 6. Prices in Wichita, Kansas, and Tulsa, Oklahoma remained virtually flat, Melody.
You know, it is interesting. It could be certain areas because, you know, you look to Texas and you had the hurricanes last year, Hurricane Harvey. All those homes were destroyed. They had to live somewhere, so they had to go out and rent. And I'm sure they weren't gouged in any way, but I do believe prices probably increased somewhat in order to compensate for all those who had homes destroyed and couldn't live there until they're repaired. And I don't know how long, again, I don't know how long it takes for those repairs and all those numbers. I mean, how you're talking about, heck, you're talking about a $500 billion through all these catastrophic events we had with the fires and the flooding last year, how long it takes for it to all filter through down to the economy to where it affects the numbers.
Yeah. Ask residents of that area of Queens that are they still haven't gotten some of their monies to rebuild from a few years ago. From I forget which hurricane that was now, but
Sandy.
Man, it devastated the East Coast.
Yeah, that was Hurricane Sandy. So, yeah, we don't know how long it takes to filter through. But again, when we get the second quarter GDP, we'll have to see how they break it down on that. But let's go ahead and talk about the geopolitical volatility. There's a lot of reporting coming out with Mike Pompeo and his discussions with North Korea. You know, he comes home and says, "Oh man, they went great. Best thing ever." And then there's commentary. There's commentary being released by North Korean calling us a bunch of gangsters. And, you know, they had no idea denuclearization meant complete denuclearization. We don't know where that's heading, but it is interesting to see the amount of clashes that is happening around the world. And you wrote about this today in the article about these clashes between nations and virtually everywhere these days. And the U.S., we're involved in many of them, if not all of them, somehow, some way, and probably half of them we probably created. So you can you take a look at a handful of countries where the most pressing conflicts are that gold and silver buyers in particular should be paying attention to. And of course, the one that, you know, the biggest and probably to me the most threatening would be Iran.
Yeah, Melody, the doomsday clock must be one tick closer to midnight. And, you know, you thought the U.S. leaving the multinational nuclear deal was giving you agita? Well, hold on to your tums. You know, Iran says it'll stop oil exports from the Strait of Hormuz if the U.S. has its way and halts Iran's crude oil sales. The Strait, as many listeners may know, is the world's foremost oil choke point. A spokesperson for the Revolutionary Guards said any hostile attempt by the U.S. will be followed by an exorbitant cost for them. If Iran's oil exports are to be prevented, he continued, we will not give permission for oil to be exported to the world through the Strait of Hormuz. Sounds like fighting words to you, too.
Absolutely, it does. And we all know that Iran is OPEC's third biggest oil producer. And they do export about, 2.3, maybe 2.4 million barrels a day of crude in June. And this was according to the oil ministry.
That's true. And the Strait of Hormuz is at the mouth of the Persian Gulf. And that's where tankers carry about one-third of all global seaborne traded crude oil. It's just a huge focal point, and the tensions that are going to rise as a result of this threat. I mean, who knows what happens? But, you know, renewed U.S. sanctions on Iran that are scheduled to take effect in November and, you know, Iran's bellicose response this weekend, you know, they both come amid rising tensions that have pitted Iran against Saudi Arabia and other Gulf Arab nations that have maintained close ties with the U.S. These latest comments from Iran followed remarks by a U.S. State Department official who said last Monday that the U.S.'s goal is to increase pressure on the Iranian regime by reducing to zero its revenue from crude oil sales. Reducing to zero. And that's pretty clear there. President Trump said Saudi Arabia, you know, could and should boost production to make up for potential losses from Iran and also Venezuela. The White House said over the weekend that King Salman bin Abdulaziz affirmed that Saudi Arabia does have 2 million barrels a day of spare production capacity, which it will use if and when necessary to ensure market balance and stability. Now, blocking the Strait of Hormuz, Melody, or any other part of the Persian Gulf is beyond provocative. Such an action by Iran would literally invite a shot across the bow from any number of countries who have naval vessels in the region, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, China. Yeah, there is little question of the result, and it's spelled W-A-R.
And you know what, and I believe we're going to be talking about Trump and Putin as they're scheduled to meet next week. And so it doesn't matter, you know, as far as all this intelligence and criminal investigations and collusion, whatever you want to call it, it's going on. I think there's a lot more serious nature of things. And, you know, like Syria, Ukraine, Dave?
Yeah. Yeah, the upcoming 2018 version of hacking, manipulating U.S. elections, their federal, state, and local systems. Now, I guess on the other side of the ruble, you know, the U.S. hasn't exactly endeared itself with Vladimir Putin and his cronies lately either. I mean, just ask his fellow countrymen and women how those U.S. sanctions are affecting their already meager pocketbooks and kitchen tables. And inquire, you know, of his dozen or so billionaire oligarch buddies, Putin's, that is, who've essentially been shut off from their assets around the world. How are they doing?
Oh, my heart bleeds for them. But,
I thought it would.
my heart bleeds. But, you know, they are scheduled, President Trump and Putin, they are scheduled to meet next week. They're supposed to have different meetings, but it's a private meeting between the two. And they're supposed to meet next Monday in Helsinki. And does he meet with Putin before or after he meets with NATO?
I believe it's after. I mean, NATO isn't it July 12th to the 15th or 16th? That's this week. And then he'll fly off in Finland. That's right, in Helsinki, Finland, where he'll hook up with his pal Vlad. You know, the official agenda calls for the two of them to talk about Syria and Ukraine. The unofficial agenda, your guess is as good as mine. But, you know, one thing's for sure. I mean, despite how positive the joint summit communique and the related photo ops are likely to paint, you know, their discussions, underlying tensions, which, you know, I think we can say are getting stronger, you know, will still be there, especially if one of the leaders tries to one-up the other. You know, never forget, Russia still has a reported 6,800 nuclear warheads pointed toward the U.S. and other countries around the world. I mean, however many of them actually still work is anyone's guess. I mean, but, you know, for now, we probably ought to assume that virtually all of them do. And the U.S. has about 6,600 warheads and a total of 14,500 or so warheads held by all of the world's nuclear powers. You know, even though the U.S. and Russia do account for over 92% of that total.
You know, and you know, when we're talking about these various places around the world, it's just brewing. It's just a matter of time until something happens. It's just like they're all positioning themselves, and we've been taken down this road before. I mean, heck, there was always reports that we'd be in war with Iran back in 2002. There was reports we'd be in, you know, we'd have these wars, you know, all along. There's always the rumors of wars, and thank God they don't happen. I mean, we had the Iraqi war, but and you know, we're still in Afghanistan and all this kind of things that are still going on. But it's not quite the same as with Russia and China and these countries that have just as many, like Russia has just as many warheads as we do. And
I mean, you know, regardless of their struggling economy, you know, and how unhappy, you know, a vast portion of its citizenry, well, at least how they look in some of the photos that that we see. I mean, I don't underestimate this grizzly of a bear. It's not a panda bear. It's a lot more potentially vicious.
You write that NATO has between 5,000 to 7,000 troops, mainly from the U.S., Germany, U.K., and Canada, in four countries along the Russian border. NATO generals believe that 5,000 additional troops could be quickly deployed. What about Russia?
Well, Russia has a reported 3.6 million servicemen and women, Melody, about 1 million of which are in active duty. The others are reservists. You know, once a heavily drugged, only a heavily drugged blindfolded person, you know, wouldn't realize that Russia could more quickly deploy a significant portion of that 3.5 million of that, you know, whether it's the 1 million plus some of the reservists of their combat ready troops to the European borders if things got really out of hand. I mean, the think tank RAND Corporation estimates that Russia would outnumber NATO forces in the event of a conflict in these major ways. One, battle tanks, 6-to-1, infantry fighting vehicles, 5-to-1, and rocket artillery, 270-to-0. That lopsided conventional supremacy, at least in numbers, I mean, together with the silly amount of nuclear weapons still in existence, you know, we all hope that that results in a continued mutually, you know, assured destruction deterrent. You know, nevertheless, as I said, you know, don't underestimate Russia, Melody.
And then we have North Korea. I mentioned, prior this program about the meeting between him and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
I think my favorite line of the day came from Mr. Pompeo, who said, "We're depending on Chairman Kim." Well, good luck with that one, Mr. Secretary. You know, he was responding to statements made by North Korean officials suggesting that the Rhodes state may no longer be interested in denuclearizing, as they supposedly were just 1 month ago. But, I mean, things are looking up. I mean, roughly 23 days ago, our president, in a moment of surreal clarity, tweeted, "There's no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. Sleep well tonight." Well, my, how things have changed in just a little over 3 weeks.
Well, we're going to kind of hope that this is just a little blip in the continuing effort to denuclearize them. But
indeed,
we're just out of time now. We're heading into a break. We'll be right back right after these few short commercials.
Each and every food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today. today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231. And the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. We're finishing up the geopolitical... what were we finishing up, Dave?
geopolitical rising tensions throughout the world and the handful of nations that, you know, we believe are, you know, where you find the most of that and who are really largely responsible for these growing worldwide tensions.
And one of these days it's going to pop, and it's all positive for gold and silver, because this is one of the reasons why you buy gold and silver. And, you know, all we hear about is how great things are. We're never really told how bad and the risk and the volatility that we face. And, you know, we talked about North Korea, we talked about Iran, we talked about Russia, and now we also have China with the tariffs. And, I mean, the list just continues to grow, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we don't have to spend too much time in the tariffs, because we've been talking a lot about it, just because they've so dominated the world headlines. But, you know, in fact, that's only one of the reasons to be concerned with that country in a geopolitical sense. I mean, there's also China's growing military presence in the South China Sea. You know, it's maneuvering to replace the dollar with its own currency, the yuan, to back future purchases of oil. You know, its grand Belt and Road Initiative, and most of all, its disciplined commitment to long-term planning. You know, if patience is a virtue, you know, China, it seems, has more staying power than the U.S., especially now after President for Life Xi Jinping got the party nod to eliminate the former two-term limit for the Chinese presidency. You know, China's now developed plans for 2018, 2025, and 2050, when it explicitly seeks to replace the U.S. as the world's most dominant economic and military power. I mean, the end of the term limit, especially, Melody, I mean, boy, that really paves the way for Xi to shape his legacy and, you know, his country's direction for literally decades, you know, long after the Trump presidency has been replaced several times over. You know, and China is already on the move economically. In 2000, I found this illuminating. China controlled just 4% of the world's economy. The U.S. controlled 31%. Today, China's control has jumped almost fourfold to 15%, while the U.S. has fallen by about a quarter to 24%. You know, that's an interesting development. You know, we've also talked about its tightening ties with Europe and Japan, you know, with the U.S. Seemingly in some kind of retreat right now on global trade. You know, in China, we've talked about forcing U.S. companies, you know, to share its technologies with them, its corporate secrets, to create joint ventures, you know, with China. China's spending on infrastructure, you know, 9% of GDP, three times what we're spending right now. You know, China's apparently so much capacity to build that it's now exporting its unused materials and labor to other countries to build their infrastructure. And, you know, lastly, you know, China's economy is growing three times as fast as ours, even though theirs is slowing down and ours is starting to build back up again. But at current projections, China's GDP will be larger than ours in a maximum of 10 years. So I say this: China, not North Korea, not Russia, not any other nation, rogue or otherwise, is the greatest threat to the United States. So I encourage everyone, keep a close watch on them. Melody.
And, you know, I hear all the time, well, China has more debt than we do, so, you know, they're not a threat and so forth. They do. But they did build their infrastructure first, and where we just took our debt to create more programs just to keep Wall Street happy. And that is the difference. And so I'm not saying that their debt being greater than ours is, nothing to worry about, because they're in worse shape than we are. It's different, and debt is debt. And, you know, they've built up their military. I mean, they've done things that I don't think people were expecting them to do in the short amount of time that they've done it. And, you know, it's, I don't know where this is all headed, but I do know that if you don't have gold and silver to protect your paper dollars, you're going to hurt a lot worse than those that have taken the time to find out about gold and silver and to give us a call at 800-375-4188. I'm going to go ahead and go into Turkey.
And turkey time, it's not even Thanksgiving.
I know, it's turkey time. And but they've dismissed thousands of state employees under emergency decree for alleged links to terrorism groups.
That's amazing.
This was published officially in the Gazette early on Sunday. Over 18,000 people, including nearly 9,000 police officers, 6,000 members of the military, and hundreds of teachers and academics were sacked. All their passports are going to be canceled. Turkey has been under a state of emergency for nearly 2 years after they declared after a coup attempt in July of 2016. And, of course, Erdogan blames a U.S.-based cleric for orchestrating the coup and has sacked or arrested people suspected of links to him. The cleric, Fethullah Gulen, denies the allegations, but the purge has broadened to include other terrorism groups with more than 130,000 people dismissed.
Wow.
Sunday's decree also reinstated 148 people previously sacked through emergency.
Thanks for little.
We're going to can 130,000 people and bring back 148.
We're going to be 148. There you go. Go ahead.
What I find interesting, though, is what's happening in England with as they're preparing for the Brexit exit.
You know what, Melly? I got to tell you, if I had more time, I mean, and I'd pay to subscribe to a service that shows the British Parliament, and it's very earthy nature. I just love the unruliness, the brutal honesty, the cracking of fellow members of Parliament. But, you know, British PM Theresa May said today that preparations for a no-deal Brexit would be stepped up and that Parliament should be prepared for a number of different outcomes. May's comments followed the abrupt resignation of a key member of her cabinet, Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson. David Davis, the minister directly charged with handling Britain's exit from the European Union, resigned only hours before. Now, May's critics seized on the dual departures to chastise her for her handling of Brexit and to suggest that her government is ill-suited to facilitate, you know, the complex disentanglement of two of the world's major economies. The pound, which had erased its earlier gains against the dollar following Johnson's resignation, fell even further after May's Brexit comments.
You know, it's interesting that it was Boris Johnson that resigned. But you have both May and you have the European Union leaders. They've been reluctant to address this possibility of the EU and the UK failing to reach an agreement on Britain's departure from the European Union. Failure to reach a deal could imperil the European Union's budget, as well as the rights of citizens in the UK and the EU to live and travel away from home. On Friday, May won a victory over the fiercest Eurosceptics in her cabinet. May's government signed off on a plan for a so-called soft Brexit that would preserve many of the trade and regulatory ties between the EU and the UK. And you know what's interesting, Dave, is just like we, you know, all they talk about is, you know, the soft Brexit, you know, a hard Brexit. You know, they're not really giving any details on on the agreements.
I think they're afraid to.
The European Union and the UK. I mean, why did Johnson, other than, you know, Boris Johnson resigning and saying, well, you know, this just isn't satisfactory. Well, why? You know, give us the details.
We'll know in a day or two, I suspect, as he starts hitting the talk show.
I guess that's what we have to
circuit,
wait for.
You know, so. But, you know, talk about a desire for transparency and the lack of it, you know, in the execution of you know, its exit strategy. It's like, boy, they're a world apart there. But, you know, it's again, I mean, I'm a firm believer in, you know, negotiating in private, but then giving your you know, your stakeholders, in this case, the public, you know, a reasonable update, you know, the, you know, what are the issues, and, you know, just don't keep everyone in the dark. It just leads to, you know, to more frustration and rising tensions, especially as close as the vote was there for the UK to leave the EU. Well, anyway, Melody, you know, we talked, you mentioned earlier about, you know, infrastructure in the U.S. and how, you know, China took the initiative to build a lot of theirs first, and now it's spending over $1 trillion to build or rebuild European, largely European infrastructure through its Belt and Road Initiative. Well, you know, one of the criticisms of our country is that we have an aging electrical grid and just a power infrastructure, and that certainly came to roost over the weekend. About 29,000 Los Angeles area homes and businesses remained without power yesterday in the wake of a brutal weekend heat wave. You know, utility crews have restored power to more than 57,000 customers since the spell swept through the region on Friday. But peak energy demand climbed past 5,700 megawatts Saturday, surpassing the department's estimate of roughly 5,500 and marking the second highest weekend day use ever recorded in Los Angeles. You know, that was down from almost 6,300 megawatts on Friday, which broke the previous July record of just about 6,200. That was set 12 years ago. Melody.
You know, it's, you know, some of the portions, the city's electrical system did sustain some major damage from the record-breaking heat. This goes into damage in some of the neighborhoods to underground cables, overhead wires, and transformers. You have these outages might take anywhere from 24 to 48 hours to fix. Some could take longer. Adding that there could be more than 700 individual incidences in the system Saturday. I also believe that we, you know, I mentioned on this program, Comcast has had outages across this country in the past 2 months on a regular basis. I've been affected twice, and I believe it's part of the infrastructure too. You know, I've been told years ago that the optic cables that they lay can't keep up with the new technology. They're overheated. They are over, you know, they're just overloaded with this new technology and the demand and so forth, and they're not replacing the cables. It takes too long. And I was being told that these fiber optic cables can't be replaced in, you know, quick enough time to really do any major infrastructure upgrades. So one of these days, that alone might just fail. You know, forget any type of, you know, heat, you know, that could disrupt your systems and you know, numerous other reasons that your power grid might fail. but they could just be, you know, it's just our infrastructure is old.
Indeed. Indeed. And very hackable.
Yes.
You know, we have about a minute left in the show, Melody. Perhaps we should end on somewhat of a fun note for listeners.
Well, yeah, I just want to mention this because I think it's important. We'll save the. How about if we save that fun thing for Wednesday? You know me. I'm not a fun kind of a.
whatever your pleasure.
I do think this is interesting though. The pharmaceutical companies, President Trump, in a tweet today, had called on Pfizer and other drug makers. They should be ashamed for increasing drug prices. But you know, we don't know if that's part of. We've had a lot of those manufacturing plants in Puerto Rico closed because of the hurricane. I was surprised to realize what Wendy Wilson told us. So much. What was it like? 80% or something like that comes from. A very large part comes from Puerto Rico. So,
that was surprising.
Yeah, pharmaceutical companies increased the prices of 104 drugs last week. And Pfizer raised the price of 41 drugs by as much as 9%, although it did lower prices on 5 drugs as much as 44%. So the increases came despite President Trump's promise in May that companies would announce massive voluntary price cuts in 2 weeks. So Trump said...
Hey!
Yeah.
There you go. Good timing.
And we're done. I'm going to be back tomorrow with Butch Paul. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us today. And we'll be back tomorrow. So, until then, be safe, good night, and God bless. Thank you,
Dave. Bye-bye.
And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.